lesson of the huge symbolic importance of constitutional decisions. Douglas would say that he had hoped to gain support from the other justices to make Endo into a constitutional case. Even according to this retelling, though, Douglas was willing to join Black's opinion in Korematsu. And there is little contemporaneous evidence to suggest that Douglas really tried to convince his colleagues to make Endo into a constitutional decision. The truth is that the young Douglas of 1944, though already interested in being seen as Brandeis's successor, was still driven by loyalty to Roosevelt, the Democratic Party, and his own political aspirations. He had not yet developed the commitment to individual liberty that would join with his legal realism to make him a great justice. Without a specific constitutional ideal to guide it, legal realism made a poor match with constitutional judging. In contrast to Douglas, three justices were profoundly concerned about the effects of the Korematsu decision. Roberts was deeply troubled by the way a single sentence in his 1942 Pearl Harbor Commission report had become the basis for systematic internment. His dissent eviscerated Black's formalistic and absurd insistence that the only issue before the court was evacuation from the West Coast, not the internment itself. Roberts's opinion reflected the enormous frustration he felt at the way the court was using legal technicalities, just as the president had, to legitimize the policy of detention. Murphy's dissent focused still more bravely on the shameful character of the detentions. As a result of his experiences as mayor of racially polarized Detroit, governor of Michigan, and governor of the Philippines, Murphy had a powerful commitment to racial justice. At the time the curfew case was decided, Murphy had already been concerned about the racial motivation of the detention, but allowed his dissent to become a concurrence. Now he decided the time was right to make a stand. In impassioned terms, he argued that there was no real evidence of espionage, and that the detention was frankly racist. The other justices were accustomed to writing off Murphy as a bleeding heart, as well as a Catholic crusader who believed God was always on his side. Frankfurter went further. He addressed Murphy in a note as, "Dear God." Another time he wrote to him, "It is lucky for God that you are probably mortal. Otherwise, he'd be out of a job." After Murphy's death, Frankfurter said that Murphy was a strange mixture of mystic aspirations and as extreme a case of self-love as I have experienced. Whatever its drawbacks, though, the self-righteous side of Murphy's personality served him in good stead when writing his Korematsu dissent. Moved by the plight of the detainees, he was unafraid to disagree with his colleagues, from whom he was already alienated. Standing against Roosevelt and his fellow Roosevelt appointees, Murphy spoke honestly and with considerable moral clarity about one of the worst episodes of racial discrimination in U.S. history. To the extent any justice preserved the dignity of the court in one of its lowest moments, it was Murphy. Jackson's dissent, one of his best-known, most powerful, and most enigmatic opinions, was different from the other two. While Roberts and Murphy focused on the treatment of the Japanese Americans, Jackson was worried about the Constitution. The Korematsu decision, he believed, created a serious danger. The court was sitting in judgment of a military order issued by a general in wartime. Military orders had to be made quickly and ruthlessly. Therefore, Jackson thought, they should not be subject to the ordinary standard of reasonableness that courts use to evaluate legality. Subjecting the military to judicial review would be bad for military decision-making. The prospect of being reviewed by civilians who would be asking if their actions were reasonable might distort generals' judgment. To make matters worse, once the courts approved the constitutionality of a military order, they would find themselves in the position of approving wartime deviations from constitutional norms that would have no place under conditions of peace. That would distort the fabric of the Constitution for all time. Jackson offered a memorable war-related metaphor. The principle, then, lies about like a loaded weapon ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim of an urgent need. Jackson's comparison of a bad constitutional precedent to a loaded weapon has become a classic of constitutional logic, and for good reason. According to Jackson's pragmatist view, constitutional law must be shaped to fit the particular needs of the case at hand. Above all, the Constitution must work. To work, it must be flexible, not dogmatic. driven by careful, balanced judgment, not by grand pronouncements or even by general rules. Broad principles, like one approving detention, are by their nature difficult to limit to particular circumstances. They are, therefore, the enemies of constitutional pragmatism. And as enemies, such principles are not inert, but active. They influence justices in future cases. Through the work of precedent, said Jackson, the bad constitutional decision becomes an evil demiurge. It possesses a generative power of its own, and all that it creates will be in its own image. Jackson was recognizing that constitutional principles, though expressed by the judges who apply them, also have lives of their own. Jackson, however, did not think that the right answer was for the Supreme Court to overturn the military orders. Looking back at the curfew decision, which he now regretted joining, Jackson predicted that most of the time courts would defer to military decision-making and so create bad constitutional doctrine. That led to a serious problem. How should the court decide Korematsu's case? To uphold the military order would distort constitutional law. To strike it down would inappropriately second-guess military authority. Jackson's answer to this legal puzzle was irregular, to say the least. Jackson proposed that the court overturn Korematsu's criminal conviction. But at the same time, Jackson thought, the court should not order the military to release the internees. Korematsu and the others would remain in military custody in their camps. Jackson was saying that Congress lacked the constitutional authority to criminalize violation of the military order. But he was also saying that the court lacked the authority to order the release of persons detained by the military pursuant to that order. When it came to war, the laws passed by Congress were to remain silent, without effect. Yet the court was to remain silent about whatever measures the executive took in pursuance of that war. Outside the bounds of Jackson's pragmatic constitutional philosophy, his position would have been incoherent. But for him, the only relevant question was whether it would enable the effective functioning of the government. Until he read a draft of Jackson's dissent, Frankfurter had intended to remain silent in the Japanese-American internment cases. No other justice combined, as he did, a general preference for judicial restraint with overwhelming support of the Roosevelt administration's wartime actions, not to mention ongoing contact with the War Department. His lengthy soliloquy to the other justices in the Saboteurs case, in which he was prepared to subordinate individual rights to the war effort, seems to have remained his position when it came to the Japanese Americans. Given that his own aged uncle had been detained by the Nazis,